Are you tired of the same boring and unhealthy diet of corporate media propaganda and the distraction du jour? Your antidote is here at Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Real, revolutionary, and relevant news and talk with fascinating and brilliant guests. Prepare to be informed and motivated with your friend and host, Cindy Sheehan.
Welcome back to the Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. This week I have two special guests. First, I will be chatting with Gary Girardi, who is involved in the National Network Opposing Militarization of Our Youth. And we will be talking about ways we can oppose the militarization of our youth and change this country into one that is more fair and more peaceful. Then, for this Labor Day, I'll be speaking with community activists and my friend Al Osorio about the very important prison strike and how we can support that. So first, it's going to be Gary Girardi. Stay tuned for him. And right after Gary, stay tuned for Al Osorio. Gary Girardi, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you're here in your role as, are you the director of National Network Opposing Militarization of Our Youth?
Actually, I'm a staff person that deals with the communication office.
Oh, okay, great. So tell us a little bit about yourself and then talk a little bit about your organization.
Well, my personal story, I came from cultural organizing, not from political organizing. I was living in the San Diego-Tijuana region, developing kind of new forms of cultural spaces, sort of comunitarios, engaging the Chicano community and the Mexican community by establishing art spaces that also integrated political events and art events too. So that was sort of my foundation. I did that for a long time, 20 years.
Wow.
And then I came to a different understanding about community work. I saw that there was a big hole in that experience where there weren't venues for people to engage in political work as a social action and activity. And that was something we actually experimented with in the venues we produced on the border. And it wasn't popular with some of the establishment figures in the communities. But the community that we were addressing engaged with it perfectly. Mm-hmm. It gave it a lot more context, what they were experiencing in their own lives, in their housing and educational opportunities, their own political perspectives were better expressed through cultural space that integrated art, performance, poetry, actually political events as well.
Okay, and then how did you get involved in
do you just guys say NOMI?
We say NOMI. How did you get involved in NOMI?
Well, I went back to school at an older age and decided to finish what I had started and got bored with when I was younger. And as a school project, I ended up doing kind of a communications project for a local organization called Project Llano in San Diego that dealt specifically with counter-recruitment activism. And I did that project. I didn't want to do something for school that was just not real. I wanted to do a real project. And after working with them for about a couple of years, they asked me to come in and help establish some of the communication requirements they needed for the national network. And that's when I started working with NOMI. So that would have been about 2003. So I've been working with them for 15 years now.
Right. So, wow. I didn't realize it was so it has been around for so long. I guess I'm like a baby. Nothing exists until I see it. So, you know what I'm talking about? So, So talk about militarization of our youth. It's not just about recruiting, is it?
Well, it has different layers. In fact, this is something that NOMI itself took up about 5 years ago, the issue of expanding its scope just beyond what would be considered kind of recruitment practice, but to address what we saw is a growing threat of cultural militarization. We realized something that should have all been very evident to most of us in our society, that there just was more and more of a saturation in our media of militarized themes in our movies, and especially the emergence of these first shooter video games that have just overwhelmed our youth.
Right.
That's become a huge assist to the military and sort of normalizing militaristic values through gameplay.
Well, it's not just about video games. Video games are actually part of the problem, but we have such a profound, what would we call it, conditioning in this country about patriotism, about the history, the false history of the United States, Pledge of Allegiance, the worship of flags, the cult of troop worship. I think trying to counter Vietnam and break that mystique around Vietnam and the soldiers, returning troops getting spat upon and things like that.
Well, you know, I think also the United States has always been in the forefront of public relations and commercial propaganda. I think that's given a lot more agency to the Pentagon and the whole project of the United States as a sort of a military power to increase the strength of their offer and of their so-called national project. So that propaganda and that advertising ability has been a real force in acculturating the American people to the idea that the United States is the good country promoting democracy around the world. And they've been very effective in promoting that idea. I think following World War II, we also saw the rise of the intelligence and security state like never before.
Right.
And that was the device that really took advantage the most of using covert means of propagandizing the people. In the 60s, the peace movement and the rebellion that took place against obvious military overreach of the United States was, I think, a surprise for the powers that be, and they had to figure out how to sort of erase that time.
Mm-hmm.
And that we've seen since 1980 and with the Ronald Reagan era, a very clear project to erase the questioning of the 60s and bring the American people back under sort of a veil of propaganda.
We had also at the end of Vietnam, the Vietnam War period, like you said, the obvious overreach of the United States Empire military. We saw that the draft was abolished. Well, wasn't abolished. I mean, they can bring it back any time, right? But I don't think they did it because they were being good guys. I think they did it because they recognized that it radicalized many people.
Well, It did. But remember, and we're old enough, both of us, to remember that the media of that time, even though our media has always been controlled, especially post-World War II, by our government's intelligence community through strong and powerful relations with our major media companies, we saw that they did actually show what was going on in, to a large extent during the Vietnam War. The narrative was pro-war,
right.
But we also saw the people coming back in body bags. We saw kind of incipient rebellion taking place among the soldiers themselves who felt the project was flawed. And that influenced the people back home. That influenced the young people back home. We don't see that anymore. Our media now is coalesced into fewer and fewer companies. They're much more careful now about controlling what the public sees about our wars. Most Americans now don't even believe we're at war.
Right.
So we have seven conflicts in the world running concurrently, mm-hmm. and generally the public's unaware of that.
Well, even after my son was killed in 2004, I had a shirt on with his picture and the dates of his birth and the dates of his death. And it was obvious it was a picture of him in the military. And a lady at the store looked at me, she goes, "Was that your son?" I said, "Yeah." And she said, "What happened to him?" And I said, "He was killed in the war." She said, "What war?"
Right.
So, yeah. You know, that's, and it's became a policy, excuse me, during the Bush regime, not to show those body bags or flag draped coffins coming back.
Correct. Well, I mean, all these are lessons learned by the military establishment and the military intelligence industrial complex. They've learned their lessons of how to control the narrative. And I think that accounts for, in a large part, for the lack of reaction within the historical peace community. Also, something that we've identified within NOMI, because we've gone now, not myself personally, but you know, this spans 30 years of people in this network doing this work. We've realized that there's been a disconnect between the value of our time and the cost and the energy it takes to live. Young people now have to struggle so much more just to make a living,
right.
to pay the rent. The cost of school is enormous. In the 60s and 70s, we had a lot more time to consider other issues and things, and it wasn't so expensive to live. And now people are hard-pressed to just get by and to make a living. Young people don't know where they're going to go with their futures and careers. You know, we're approaching a situation that many other countries understand perfectly, that young people can't even afford realistically to consider with what they're likely to be able to earn in their work, to buy a house, to really have a family. This has pressured young people in our universities in a way that they don't have maybe the willingness or attention to put toward political issues like they did in, you know, 30, 40 years ago. So that's disenfranchised a potential backlash against cultural militarism as well.
Well, in my observations and in my own life experience, I see people always ask me, "Cindy, where are the kids?" And, you know, I'm not, where are the young people? Anybody younger than my kids are kids, but where are the young people? And I say the young people are struggling to try and pay for their school to survive, and the young people who can go to school without having to go into debt or get a full-time job, they're the ones mostly whose families are profiting off these wars. So they're not going to go, they're not going to go protest them unless they're extraordinary people. And I'm not saying that, you know, it's a, it's a 100% thing, but, you know, Casey joined the military so he could be assured of a college education, and then he was killed. And my next oldest, my daughter, got her master's degree, and she's $50,000 in debt. She'll never pay that debt off, you know, unless she wins a lottery or something.
Yeah, well, this is the tragedy, I think, of the American experiment, and sort of the betrayal of the American propaganda. That we're the bastion of freedom. We're the country that struggles for democracy and tries to promote democracy in the rest of the world. And it all is the opposite.
Right.
We've become sort of a tax plantation for the military. You know, 56 to 60% now of our discretionary tax income is being filtered off by the military. What does that say about our country? What does that say about our people? You know, it's a form of debt slavery that
right,
we have
absolutely.
No, we have no option in. Nobody gives us an option how we spend our tax money.
Well, debt slaves, we're wage slaves because we have to be debt slaves in this society. And it's just, like you said, it's this horrible cycle that our young people especially are getting trapped in. And they, like you said, they see no way out. So like Casey, when he graduated from a community college, that's the way he thought would be out. You know, he was preyed upon by a recruiter, and it seemed like an attractive option to him.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we don't always think the worst about our country. I mean, in a sense, young people are vulnerable to military offers because young people still have a fairly strong streak of naivete and sort of trust in them.
Right.
And what's wrong with that? You know, wrong is when really tainted things take advantage of that trust.
And also, we had a period. He joined in 2000, so we had this period of a lot of covert wars, a lot of sanctions, a lot of economic wars, like you found when you were working in Tijuana, but no, like, active boots on the ground shooting wars. You know, we thought that we, at that point, there was some kind of peace dividend, but it was just another trap.
Well, if we look carefully now at what the United States really has become, it's questionable it's even a country anymore. It's more likely we've become the hammer of financial capital in the world. We really are an island of retreat and for global capital.
Right.
The military of the U.S. serves as sort of the enforcer of that. It maintains the fiat currency of the dollar around the world. And it's not backed by gold or silver. It's backed by violence.
Right.
And that's what the United States has become. Mm-hmm. It actually amazes me they can still managed to convince people with the same narrative that they were able to 50, 60 years ago. You know, we are the country that represents democracy and liberty in the world, when everything historically speaks to the opposite of that. And now that we see multiple engagements and basically kind of neocolonialism taking place in Africa,
right,
and now again in South America, it's very clear what's going on. We're defending corporations and corporate interests, sending young people off to fight and die for corporations under the guise of democracy or liberty. It's absurd, and I think it's falling down too. And I think it's falling down in the military as well. But I think what's frightening is a lot of the young soldiers today are more likely to follow that agenda, not concerned about democracy or freedom of people, but rather taking a possession that they're on a winning team, and it's more important to them that they're on the winning side than on defending a humanistic agenda.
Well, also, here where I live, we live just a few miles away from a major Air Force base, and it's obvious here in our town, even in the condo complex I live in, that it is just insidious. There's so many people who live here who are in the Air Force, and it seems like it has become just this cancerous part. Like you said, the only thing holding the dollar up is the military. And, you know, what would our town do if this base closed? It would, for me, it would be, you know, a joyous day, but it would also be like an economic disaster for the economy here.
Well, maybe it's that disaster that needs to happen.
I agree. But this is one of the things that we see. And this is, we'll talk about the Women's March on the Pentagon. But we are marching against the bipartisan nature of militarization, because every single district in this country relies, every single university, every single district relies on the military-industrial complex for jobs and for its economy, which we know is it's just a house of cards, or just built. It's just a house built on built by straw.
Well, we're now seeing something we hadn't seen before as well. We're seeing that the war is coming home. The militarization outside the United States is taking place through our foreign policy and our direct force and those countries that basically are have client relationships with our militaristic policy are now coming home in the form of militarized police, right. a growing private military a prison complex. This is the U.S. disease coming home to bite us, bite ourselves. We're also seeing that the expansion of in our media of military themes probably coincides with their understanding that what the national project is. It's going to include expanding militarism in our own country and in the world. Like you say, almost everywhere you go now where there's any large grouping of people, the economy, a large percentage of the economy is dependent on military contracting, either directly to the Defense Department itself or through private contracting companies. Right. And this has been going on for a long time, but now it's sort of reaching sort of a crescendo point where it's beginning to overwhelm us.
I had a thought in my head, but it disappeared. So talk about how you see that synergy between NOMI and the Women's March on the Pentagon. But it's not just about NOMI. It's about us working together to combat this culture in the United States to help save our children from this and save the world. You know, we always say a better United States, or even a collapse of the United States, would be better for billions of people on this planet. And when I say collapse of the United States, I'm talking about the military empire.
Well, I think any idea or concept of a sustainable society has to include the abandoning the military framework of commerce and political negotiation between countries. The only thing that comes out of militarism basically is coercion and intimidation and violence. the idea that militarism, the good side of militarism, is it keeps us safe. We've seen that it doesn't keep us safe.
Right.
We're going down the wormhole of violence, culturally, militarily. We're reaching a point where we've become a caricature of ourselves. I mean, look at the president we have now. Who would ever have dreamed any of this would come to pass?
Right.
I remember when Ronald Reagan got elected, it seemed like, how could we go more far field from a legitimate political culture than the election of Ronald Reagan? And now we've accomplished that with a reality TV show celebrity as our president. I mean, what's
Carnival
next?
Carnival huckster.
Yeah, it's just a parody of a government.
Well, what's even sadder than that is Ronald Reagan is worshipped. Like, he was some kind of brilliant president, and he was a terrible governor of California. He's the one who started the slide into the our university system being decimated, and also the rising costs of California universities. But he was a terrible president. He was a terrible governor. But he actually is worshipped as one. And Barack Obama said that Ronald Reagan was his favorite president.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no surprise.
Yeah.
I think we've reached the moment where we need to really think about change and sustainability on the community level. How that's going to be accomplished in large cities, it seems almost improbable.
Uh-huh.
But in smaller communities, maybe we have the option of starting to turn things around and create role models for how we want to run our schools, how do we want to educate our children, how do we want to treat each other as well as citizens sharing a common space. The other issue for NOMI, which is an important one, is that I think we recognize that our schools are one of the last remaining public commons that exists for Americans. And our public commons have been diminishing with the privatization of everything. You and I remember public utilities and public water company and public electrical company. And these things weren't designed to extract a huge profit for a small percentage of investors. They were services to provide for the community. We've seen the reversal of all that, and that large part is the work of Ronald Reagan's administration. The small communities can extricate ourselves from that by trying to bring back the local, bring back local food, and also to rehumanize our communities. The consumer culture of the United States has alienated us from each other, and that's created a lack of concern for each other, and horribly, it's also created a lack of concern for ourselves. In a lot of cases, people are unfulfilled because they've lacked the humanity that's been lost by the destruction of community and family and common space. So the schools for NOMI are a last place to sort of defend ourselves from indoctrinating influences. And this is the case with the military in our schools, trying to basically acclimate young people to what is perpetual war.
Right.
And to push them into careers that are going to support that. We have now military STEM programs, science, technology, engineering, and math. It's been co-opted by the Department of Defense.
Right.
They're teaching young people now how to build drones and robots. These are not skills that are going to humanize our communities. These are going to be skills that are going to be used to create weapons of destruction and weapons that are going to encourage extrajudicial murder and assassination. This is not the world we need to build. So, I mean, this is one of the reasons NOMI focuses so much on the need to engage our schools and limit access of military recruiters as much as we can, and try to let school districts understand that this is not what we want. we want our children to grow up in a country and in a world where they can look forward to a peaceful life, a life of joy, of family, of good friends, and not of fear, and not of, you know, perpetual war, and witnessing terrible destruction, and now turning destruction into a form of entertainment, which we call militainment.
That's basically
the creation of forms of entertainment that involve virtual murder and killing. You know, imagine, I used this example the other day. Imagine if we created a video game that integrated sexual violence. How would that fit into the marketplace? Do you think people would accept that? And yet we create this pornography of violence that's become enormously popular with young people and inculcating them into a normalization of violence and desensitizing them to real violence in wars. And we call that a product or something that's okay for young people to do.
Do you are you familiar with the organization Chelsea United Against Wars? Are they your network?
No, tell me.
Well, there's somebody who we're also working with in Women's March on the Pentagon, and their model, I think, is something that the Women's March on the Pentagon, Nomi and Kwa, that they call themselves, is a great model. They're a small community right outside of Boston, and they have concentrated on Chelsea High School, and they do kind of recruitment there. And it's a largely Latino population, so they have been brilliant at getting the parents to sign the opt-out forms and also to expose the military, how the military especially treats Latino immigrants. They lie to them and say they're going to get citizenship, et cetera, et cetera. And we know that has been bogus long before the Trump administration. So that's an example of a small community doing great work and just like they're not trying to change the entire world. They're just trying to change their world. And it has created a community where, you know, they have cookouts together. They have They also participate in the large mobilizations in Boston and things like that. So I think that would be, you know, a very good synergy between the Women's March on the Pentagon, NOMI, and organizations like QUA that are really making a big difference in their communities.
Well, let's use this engagement and this march as an opportunity for us to learn more about them and for them to learn about us. This is exciting.
Yes, yeah, very more exciting.
And it's the fact that it's young people doing this is so important. One of the problems in the peace movement, too, is we're aging out.
Right.
I went to London to work on the Rory Sisters International's project on demilitarizing young people and on counter-recruitment work. And I tried and made an effort to go around and talk to different peace groups and find out what was going on. And the reality was we were looking at people in their 60s, 70s, and 80s. And I'm not disparaging that.
Right.
We need all groups and ages to work together. But we've seen a real lack of young people coming into this work. And in the case of our office here, we have three young women working in the office, all in their 20s. And this is a new phenomenon. These are basically young people that are come out of anthropology, social work, that have limited work opportunities and are using their education and their time to apply to something they care about and they think is very important. I think this is also an opportunity in the United States in a time when there are limited opportunities for young people, costly educational demands, to use a year, 2 years out of their life outside of school to dedicate it to change, work as peace organizers. Learn to engage in your communities and find out what's really going on, and humanize themselves in the process. It's very important, what you expressed to me right now.
Absolutely. We are running out of time, but NOMI has a great website with a lot of resources. Can you tell our listeners where they can access that?
Well, actually, we made a page last night for the Women's March on the Pentagon. I'll give you the address.
I saw it. Yeah, I did.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you so much.
It's NOMI.org. It's NNOMY.org/WMOP.html. There's a strategy summit in Chicago this summer that shows exactly what the Pentagon's got up its sleeve for trying to bring more influence of recruitment efforts into our schools. And then a presentation we made last year showing ways that people can reach back into their schools and take them back from the Pentagon and from military recruiters. So it sort of proposes both the problem and the solution on a local level.
Perfect. And Gary, I will put those links on the posting for the blog. So Gary Girardi, thank you so much for your work. And it was great to finally talk to you. And thank you for being on Cindy Sheehan Soapbox this week.
The same for me. And I'm so excited for the Women's March. I wish you the greatest of luck and
this is just
activism.
This is a movement. It's not just a march. It's a movement. We look forward to working with you going forward.
Well, we're all with you.
Thank you. Al Osorio, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Thank you, Cindy. It's a pleasure. Pleasure to be here. Pleasure to talk to you. We met one time in San Francisco. I was in the streets. There was a die-in, and you were first running for Congress.
Oh, wow. Yeah, well, you know, you're someone who I feel very close to, even though we're not in physical proximity most of the time. So I just feel like your heart and your activism is so community-centered, and it's centered on your community. And I really think that that's the place that most people need to be.
Thank you.
So the reason I reached out to you is because you post a lot of information about what's currently happening that I'm sure a lot of people don't know about, and that's the prisoner strike.
It is, and I've learned quite a bit myself. I'm on the Bay Area Prison Strike Committee, and not as an expert, mostly just as kind of, like you said, a community activist, someone interested in things. And I'm learning so much about it, about what the prisoners endure. I mean, some of the things that are happening, we've gone from, as the U.S., there was 300,000 people in prison 50 years ago. Now we've got 2.2 million in prison.
Wow.
So that's... Yeah, a sevenfold increase, but yet they didn't build, seven new prisons for each old one. They didn't increase funding. I'm sure they're, people are down to spend money for war, but they're not down to spend money even for better health care for everybody. So the welfare of prisoners is way, way down on the list, you know.
Well, the sharp escalation of the prison industrial complex started happening, during the Clinton administration, and many people don't realize that.
They still think the Democrats are the good guys.
Right.
They're no longer even a lesser evil. They're, they're more socially acceptable evil. They say nicer things. But their impact on the people is the same.
Well, and we have a situation also here in California where our governor, Jerry Brown, is actually funded and supports the private prisons, the prison industrial complex.
Yeah, forcing people into, forcing prisoners into privatized prisons, it's like they have as few, let's say that they have very few comforts anyway. You know,
right.
they're
right.
hardly treated. But when you put them into a privatized prison and the intent is to make a profit,
right.
then it's going to be even worse. They're going to cut into things even worse. What really triggered the prison strike is in South Carolina, Lee Correctional Institution, there was a riot that broke out there, 7 dead, 22 or 29 hospitalized, I forget.
Right.
It was portrayed, you know, by the media as a prison riot, and what most people would probably view, it's like prisoners rampaging, burning, looting, smashing things, and the fact that it was only prisoners killed and wounded kind of reinforces that. But
right.
in point of fact, you know, the reason we know what happened in there is smuggled cell phone video. You know, cell phones are brought in, smuggled in, or mm-hmm. Guards will, you know, corrupt guards will trade them for favors or for money. And those videos show that the people, prisoners weren't rampaging. Many were actually trying to hide. You know, they were the only ones giving each other care.
Uh-huh.
They were the ones caring for the wounded. It was allowed to go on for 7 hours before they intervened. You know, and in this particular prison, they were really depriving them even worse than a lot of other prisons. Moldy food, overcrowding. The prison gangs were together in the same parts of the facility, so it was almost like it was inevitable this was going to happen. And this many deaths triggered activists to work on the strike and to get this going. And it takes great courage for prisoners to do anything, because to refuse to report to work, to go on hunger strikes.
Right.
There's really nobody there to report on what's actually happening.
A lot of people don't realize that many, many companies use prison labor, and of course the prisoners get paid just pennies, and these companies are profiting enormously from their labor.
They are. The companies, because much of it's prison work release. I think out of 2.2 million prisoners, it's close to 1 million are in the prison industries. And like McDonald's, all of their utensils, the uniforms, the packaging materials, all made by prisoners who get, like you said, I think it's 74 cents a day. And not, in addition to that, they get a tax credit of $2,400. For each prisoner. So McDonald's.
What?
You know, yeah.
Oh my God.
I think it's called WTOC, Work Opportunity Tax Credit. Federal tax credit, I'm reading here, a federal tax credit that grants employers $2,400 for every work release employed inmate. And work release, it's not like they're not in a halfway house. You know, they get on a bus from the prison,
right.
go to the wherever it is, and then get bus back. You know, it's a break for them in a sense, but $2,400 in for all of these, and not like McDonald's that's earning for money. Whole Foods, the tilapia farms and the artisan cheeses, I think the tilapia sold for like $12 a pound. And the prisoners raise them. They do the farming on that, and they make 74 cents a day, Whole Foods.
Geez, junk fish, though, you know, on a side note, don't eat that junk fish. But the thing is, I know you posted something about a boycott, or these are companies that are profiting off of prison labor. Those are horrible companies that I don't, you know, for many reasons, I don't use anyway.
AT&T
call
centers.
Right.
AT&T call centers.
Wow. So how can we support the prisoner strike or the prison strike, Al?
There's one is to boycott those things, the long-range demands, too. And there's also phone zaps. What they do is there's certain prisons, like, let me see, there was one in Ohio just yesterday where because of the retaliation against the prisoners, the phone numbers were put up, and people bombard them with telephone calls, and that ties up all their lines. So they call that a phone zap. I'll share those best I can, and I'll give you two sources, two that are a Facebook and an Internet source. Another is just spreading the word.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's more, people are more receptive these days. 50 years ago or 20 years ago, if you were saying, well, prisoners are on strike, people might view that as, well, that's a bunch of armed robbers are on strike. But the majority are nonviolent offenses,
right.
Drug things. Yeah. So most of us have friends or family, or many of us anyway, who are in prison, have been in prison, may go to prison, and we know them as nonviolent people who might maybe either made a mistake or got caught up or whatever.
Or they got framed, or, you know, they just got rounded up for no reason, and they're railroaded into these prisons because the capitalism needs slaves. And, you know, we've talked about the new Jim Crow, the 14th Amendment that actually just, you know, became a new slavery for African-American people and other people of color.
That's it. It's other people of color, poor people. Let me give you one place on Facebook, Bay Area National Prison Strike Solidarity Committee. That's a Facebook group that's regularly, it's a public group which is regularly updated, and there's a website, Sawamimi, SAWARIMI.org, and that has links. Amani Sawamimi is a lawyer and activist. So
awesome. So we'll put those links on the posting for the show, so people who listen to the show can go to go to those links. How does it make you feel, Al, when you see that the United States is bombing seven countries right now, saying that we're bringing freedom and democracy, when the United States has the highest percentage of its citizens incarcerated?
You know, it underscores the hypocrisy. The hypocrisy in everything the U.S. does, and has since its inception. You know, on slavery and genocide, and it continues to be based on slavery and genocide. And you know, people, that U.S. exceptionalist mindset is that we as everyone born here as a citizen or and who endorses what endorses U.S. domestic and foreign policy is are doing things for the betterment of the world, and
right.
Nothing could be further from the truth. It's the benefit of capitalism and white supremacy and imperialism.
Right.
I wonder if I could say something real quick. It's
sure.
Just about the strike dates. The strike began August 21st, and it scheduled to end on September 9th. August 21st is the anniversary of the prison rebellion in San Quentin in 1971, and September 9th was the 1971 Attica uprising.
Okay.
Attica prison. So that's the reason for the state.
Okay. That's very important.
Yeah.
Okay, Al Osorio, thank you so much, and make sure you get me those links.
I'll send them to you. I'll message them to you on Facebook.
And then so we can get them posted for everybody. Well, Al, it was great to talk to you, and thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, and we'll end this now before you have to start speaking Spanish.
Okay. Thanks, Cindy.
Bye-bye. Bye, Al. Thank you so much. Well, that's the Soapbox for this week. As always, I hope you were informed and inspired to further action. And also, as always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Don DeBar. I'd like to thank Gary Girardi and Al Osorio for their important work. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to The Soapbox. Peace out for now.